Joining us on Front and Center is the Chief Executive Officer of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization. He is a former Republican Congressman from Pennsylvania, Jim Greenwood. And Jim, welcome to Front and Center.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
One of the reasons that we want you on the program is obviously to talk about the pricing of a lot of these prescriptions, and it's particularly a story across the nation, but also here in our state of Connecticut, where you've got the only two insurance companies in the health exchange asking for really sizable increases. And among the reasons they claim is the increased price of these prescription drugs. And you were quoted in a story as saying, "Our industry has become an easy scapegoat for the real and growing problem of patient access to affordable new medications." So how about talking about this?
Sure, sure. So first off, if I may, let me just, because your listeners probably don't know this, but let me just tell you what BIO is. We're the National Trade Association for Biotechnology Companies, and we're a nonprofit membership organization. We represent about 1,000 companies who are in the field of biotechnology. And we get the fact that some of our drugs have shocking sticker prices. You know, there are oncology drugs that cost $100,000, and there are drugs that cost $200,000, $300,000, particularly when you get into the rare disease area. And we get that people will be shocked by that. But to directly respond to your question, it is not the price of drugs that are driving the insurance premiums upward. Last year, 2015, the net increase in drug spending, in the price of drugs, went up 2.8%. What's actually driving premiums increases are hospitalization costs, doctor costs, and we're a relatively small portion of that. In fact, the whole drug industry, the whole drug spend is about 14% of the healthcare spend. What actually happened was Obamacare became law, and it changed the way the health insurers world looked, and they had to go in and compete in these exchanges. And what they did is they kind of lowballed their premiums in order to be competitive and get people to sign up to their plans. And then they realized, and maybe they realized in advance, I don't know, they realized that they couldn't profit at those low premiums. So they started jacking up the premiums like very large percentages. They started charging co-insurance. So some drugs, the patient has to pay 30% of the price or more out of their pocket. And they know that all of this is unpopular. High premiums, high deductibles, high copays is very unpopular. And they decided that they needed a scapegoat. And the drug industry is always an easy industry to vilify, despite all the miraculous treatments we come up with. And so that's their public relations plan, if you will, to try to vilify us.
Well, I guess from a public perspective, who is the public to believe? Because the insurance companies are blaming the pharmaceutical companies, the hospitals are blaming pharmaceuticals and the insurance companies, and everybody seems to be blaming everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Well, so I wouldn't expect people to just believe the for-profit insurance industry or the for-profit drug companies, but you can turn to third parties. There's an outfit called Avalere, and Avalere is a disinterested third-party academic organization that recently came out, and that was there in that piece that you read. I think I was quoting them when they said that the 2017 premium increase justifications, they said outpatient 30%, professional 28%, and prescription drugs are account for 14% of those premium increases. And they did that by studying nine states, and Connecticut was, frankly, was one of those states. So you don't have to believe us. You just have to believe the scholars who have done the analyses.
Now, and you were a former member of Congress, when two pharmaceutical companies, and this is in that same story, raised their prices sharply on older drugs, you know, Congress went nuts about that. Why would Congress do that?
Well, there was a notorious case of a company called Turing, T-U-R-I-N-G, it was run by Martin Shkreli, and he's been arrested and charged in criminal counts. But he was really a hedge fund guy. He's a young guy, wanted to make a pile of money, tried it in the hedge fund market. And then what he did is he saw this drug that was used by AIDS patients that had gone generic, and there was only one company making it. He bought the company and then increased the price of the drug by like 15,000%. And it was scandalous, and it was not anything that has to do with innovating a new product. It was just taking advantage of cornering a market. That company had joined my organization about 6 months earlier. We promptly excused them from membership in our organization because that's not what we're about. We're the biotechnology innovation organization, and we're interested in innovating new drugs, not just cornering the market on old drugs. And that drug was like 50 years old. So I don't blame Congress for being upset about that.
Now, according to BIO, 1 out of 10 biotech companies turns a profit, and 90% of clinical research goes toward projects that ultimately fail. How about elaborating on that?
Yeah, so if you look back in time and say, what has this industry done? You say, we've reduced death from cancer by 25%. We've taken AIDS, which was a death sentence in recent memory. And today, if you're 20 years old and your doctor tells you you're HIV positive, you'll probably live well into your 70s. We've done miraculous things, vaccinations that have basically eliminated whole classes of terrible diseases in children. And what we're going to do is even more astounding: cell therapy, genetic gene therapy, using the body's immune system to cure cancer. So all of these things we're working on, including Alzheimer's disease and diabetes and all of the rest. It is extremely difficult science. And to come up with a new treatment for one of these diseases makes putting a man on the moon look like a walk in the park. It's really complicated science. It's exciting science, and it's producing miracles, but it is the case that 90% of biotech companies fail. And 90% of the projects that biotech companies fail, by project I mean let's invent this new drug for this disease. And so it's a highly risky business, and it's completely driven by the ability, the willingness of people to invest in us, whether they're venture capitalists investing in small startup companies, or whether they're the Connecticut Teachers Association investing, in for purposes of their pensions. These investors are not interested in curing diseases. They're interested in getting a high return on investment. So the basic economics are that when you have something that's as risky as this enterprise is, the returns have to reflect that. And so that when you look at the fact that it on average takes about $2.6 billion over 12 years to develop one of these drugs, you can understand why sometimes the initial price is quite high.
Talking with Jim Greenwood, Chief Executive Officer of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization, which is based in our nation's capital. Jim is a former congressman from Pennsylvania, and of course, we're smack dab in the middle of a presidential election. Donald Trump says he could save taxpayers billions by negotiating with drug makers on prices. Hillary Clinton says she'll release her plan in September that would fight drug costs. What do you say about all of this, particularly being a former member of Congress?
Well, when I was a member of Congress, I was trying save the Medicare and the Medicaid program dollars. I understand that. But I think in the heat of a campaign, it's a very popular thing to make statements like both presidential candidates and Bernie Sanders before them and others did, that they know people are up in arms about the cost of insurance and the cost of drugs and their out-of-pocket costs and so forth. So it's a very popular thing to do. But it's a very short-sighted thing to do. We lead the world in biotechnology innovation, and we will find cures for Alzheimer's, which is already costing us hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and will cost us $1 trillion a year by the time the baby boomers like myself are through the system. So we're trying to invent these new cures to end suffering and dramatically reduce the cost of healthcare. And if you take a short-sighted view and say, well, you know, we're going to impose government price controls, the investors will just simply go elsewhere. They'll just take their money, and they will not put it in these startup biotech companies. They won't invest in the pharmaceutical companies. And you can have all of the drugs that are on the shelf today very inexpensively. You just shouldn't expect any new ones because there won't be any money for innovation. And remember that these prices don't last forever. You know, we have a patent on these drugs, and when the patent life of the drug expires, then the generic companies come in, and 90% of the drugs that patients use today are generic, and the price plummets. And that's as it should be. It works well. You have high prices initially, which incentivize investment to pursue the science. The patients get the benefit of the breakthroughs, and then for as long as those drugs are on the market after the patent expires, they're relatively inexpensive. So one should be very careful about taking apart the system that has produced such amazing results.
Well, don't these candidates know that? Don't they know how research works, how investment works?
Not necessarily. Donald Trump is hardly a student of biomedical innovation. Hillary Clinton probably knows more about it because she's involved in healthcare. But, you know, people, you know, I was in elective office for 24 years, and I've been around the political system my whole life. And unfortunately, people have a tendency to say what they think they need to say in order to get elected. And hopefully when the election's over and the smoke clears and we start the next presidential administration, the next Congress, hopefully cooler heads will prevail.
Well, and that's the sad part about it, though, Jim, because they, for whatever reason, maybe they don't know how the system works, or they know a little bit about the system. Rather than leveling with the public, don't they pander to the public? And then after the election, the public becomes even more disappointed because there's no way they can institute their policies not knowing how the environment works in this area, right?
That is all too true, and it creates cynicism, and it is why people do become disenchanted with the political system because of those kinds of things. You know, since you mentioned it, one of the things that I find missing in the commentary is I turn on the TV every morning or I turn on the radio and I hear, well, President Trump is going to do this and President Clinton is going to do that. Well, nobody ever analyzes actually what is the likelihood that any of this stuff is going to happen, given the divided Congress, and, you know, Republicans are probably going to control the House after the election. So I think the candidates would be in the long run better by being a little more forthright about what's doable, and because I think people will understand if a candidate says, this is what I think I can get done, not promising them the moon.
From a healthcare perspective, because you're on both sides, obviously, could we hear Trump say, I'm going to eliminate Obamacare? We hear Clinton say she's going to improve on Obamacare. What can be done, particularly as we do see the rising costs of healthcare?
Well, I think as a practical matter, as I just mentioned, the House is going to stay Republican. The Senate is either going, it may stay Republican, it may go Democrat, and one of these two people are going to be elected president. So we will have a divided government, which means that that despite the fact that the House has repeatedly voted to repeal Obamacare, it's never going to pass in the Senate because you really need 60 votes in the Senate to get something done. And it certainly isn't going to be signed by a President Clinton. As a practical matter, what I think is more likely to happen is incremental changes in the current system. But people are not going to stand for going back to the days when you couldn't get coverage if you had a pre-existing condition. And so there are things about Obamacare that are liked. There are things that are about Obamacare that are despised. And I think, realistically, we'll see some gradual changes in the system, hopefully for the better. And in terms of saving dollars in the healthcare system, I would continue to make the case that that my industry, the biotechnology industry, is where the greatest hope lies, because you can tinker around with public policy all you want, but if we come up with a really significant treatment for Alzheimer's, think about the impact on the healthcare system that would have.
A couple more questions with our guest, Jim Greenwood, here on Front and Center. So from a campaign perspective, when it comes to the pharmaceuticals, when we hear the insurance companies even talking about the high cost of drugs, what as a public should we be understanding when those statements are made?
Well, I think you should. I would hope that the public would understand that we can't have it both ways. We can't say we want to cure Alzheimer's, we want to cure diabetes, we want to cure cancer, we want to cure Parkinson's and ALS, all these horrible, horrible diseases that keep stealing our loved ones from us. You can't say we want all of those things, and at the same time we want ham-handed government policies that will impose price controls, because there's a long, long history of what happens with price controls, and it usually means the end of an industry. And the promise of biotechnology is so extraordinary policymakers and the public need to be very, very careful about disassembling the system that's bringing us so much promise. Remember, as I said earlier, These drug prices are temporary. The drugs become generic and the price goes down. And so that system is serving us really well. We're only 14% of the healthcare spend. Okay? So we're not what's driving the cost of healthcare. We're not what's driving insurance premiums. To the contrary, we're the only aspect of the healthcare system that's actually reducing expenditures by keeping people out of hospitals.
And again, the public needs to understand the cost of this research. For example, I heard on the news the other day that as we look for something to combat the Zika virus, it's going to cost a lot of money in order to do the research, right?
Well, of course it is. It's, as I said in the beginning, it's very, very risky. It's very, very expensive. It takes on average 10 to 12 years and sometimes 15 years to develop these drugs. If we want that if we want investors to continue to invest in these kinds of companies, they're going to have that return on investment. And we can afford this. I think what we have to do, where the patient feels it, is in the out-of-pocket costs. So if you go to a drugstore and you hand the pharmacist your prescription, and 5 minutes later she hands you your drugs, your medicine, and says your share of this is this drug costs $1,000, your share is $300. You go, well, how can I be expected to pay that? Well, that's not the drug companies doing that. That's the insurance companies doing that. And it's like that Liberty auto insurance company commercial that we see on TV all the time. You pay your premiums month after month, year after year, and then you have an accident and they expect you to pay more money. Well, people pay their premiums and pay their premiums for health insurance. And then when they get sick, they don't expect their insurance company to leave them high and dry. And when insurers demand those kind of out-of-pocket expenditures from patients, I think that's exactly what they're doing.
A final question. Can we get through this divided government, which seems to exist year after year, or is actually divided government good?
Oh, well, I'll give you my philosophy on that, having served for a long time. I think the country is completely, the government is dysfunctional because it's so partisanly divided right now. And I think a compromise shouldn't be a dirty word. And which the way the system should work, let's say we're looking at Obamacare. Instead of one side saying we want to repeal it and that's it, that's the only thing we're going to talk about, and the other side saying we want to maintain it, the only thing we want to talk about, they should compromise. And when they compromise, they could say, after the compromise legislation is signed, Republicans could say, well, we made a compromise, we didn't want to, but there weren't enough Republicans in Washington, so we had to. So if you don't like the outcome, send us more Republicans in the next election. And the Democrats would say exactly the same thing. We compromised, we did things we didn't want to, but in the name of improving the things for the country as a whole, we did that. We had to compromise because there aren't enough Democrats down here. Send us more Democrats. And then the voters can go to the polls in the next election and decide who they want to side up with. That's the way it should work, but unfortunately it doesn't.
Jim, anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up our interview?
No, I just I think probably the thought that I would leave with you is that there's nothing more precious than the time that technology innovation provides us and our loved ones, and let's keep it going.
Jim Greenwood, Chief Executive Officer of the Biotechnology Innovation Organization and a former congressman from Pennsylvania, has been our guest. Jim, thanks for joining us on Front and Center.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.